The Jason Rantz Show.
Jason Rantz hosts a radio show in Seattle, and he has, as always, the details for us exclusively.
Jason Rantz, our Seattle guy, is with us now.
Jason Rantz, always great to have you in focus. Thank you.
Hey, Jason, I think you're all right, and thanks for being on the show.
An update on what's happening in your Pacific Northwest.
Some mixed news in the jobs report. We'll take you through it with Edward Lawrence, White House correspondent for Fox Business. Cliff Mast stops by to tell us where the snow actually will hit Western Washington this week, or this weekend. Plus, there are a lot of volunteers who are hard at work to overturn some of the very fringe left-wing causes and strategies and policies and, in some cases, laws that are being pursued here in Washington State. You can actually help overturn this stuff if you get activated in your community. We're going to tell you how this hour of the Jason Rantz Show. So, let's get into it.
The monologue.
I think we're going to regret what public health officials did to us during COVID more than we realize. And I say that from the perspective of someone who believes we're going to severely regret it. And I wonder if I'm downplaying how much regret there will be. And I say that in the context of the story from the Associated Press about Washington State and how the flu has been apparently hitting the state hard enough to be considered a very high activity of flu across the state of Washington. According to public health officials, as of yesterday afternoon, they said there were 1,200 new flu cases between November 13th and 19th. And that says it's more than double the case count of previous weeks. And I look at a story like this, and I'll be totally honest. I said when I first saw this, I was like, so? And? And then, of course, they hit you with some tragedy where they say seven died from the flu in Washington State so far. And certainly we don't want to see anyone dying of a disease or a virus like the flu because it's treatable, right? But I also looked at that and say, okay, people die of the flu. My father died of the flu. I'm very well aware that the flu can be deadly for some folks, but seven is not a lot. That doesn't dismiss the people who suffered and the families who suffer now, not at all. They were important, but seven is not a number that is alarming. And 1,200 new flu cases during the flu season, to me, is not alarming. But maybe it is. Maybe I should think of it as alarming. But I just don't trust public health officials anymore. Not necessarily that they're lying, but that they might be overstating the case. They say in this AP story, influenza type A has been the most common flu strain found in recent weeks. Officials said 7.5% of physicians' visits between the 13th and 19th were for flu-like illnesses, up from a 1.8% baseline. Okay. Okay. They say on average of an average of 193 flu deaths were recorded between 2014 and 2020. The peak was 296 deaths during the 2017 to 2018 flu season. So we're nowhere close at seven. Now, they say there were no flu deaths reported between 20 and 2021. I don't believe that, right? 2020 to 2021, this was the pandemic. They were throwing every statistic they could to make COVID seem as threatening as humanly possible. Some did it with good intent. Others did it to control you and to manipulate you and to hang on to power. But does anyone actually believe there were zero deaths from 2020 to 2021? Not even one? Again, seven is low, and the general number of annual deaths in Washington State is low. But to say that there was zero in 2020 to 2021 is as silly as it was when they claimed that the flu virus just completely went away. No one was getting sick with the flu. Now, I certainly believe that the numbers were down during 2020 to 2021 because of the lockdown. People just weren't outside and interacting with people, thus smaller chances of being exposed to the flu virus. And obviously wearing a mask when talking about people who maybe are symptomatic with the flu and are sneezing or coughing everywhere and you've got a mask on, it mitigates some of the risk. There's no doubt. But I look at a story like this and I'm asking myself, what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to say? What am I supposed to think? Is being framed in a way that it's serious. And I just don't see it as serious. And whether or not I should, whether I'm right to not is not the point. It's that I'm questioning whether or not I should take this seriously. or a little bit more seriously than I, because even in a normal year, if you tell me that it's a bad flu season, I'm not going to take it that seriously, but I certainly would be more alert to the fact that the virus is out there. And I obviously, I don't want to get the flu. I don't want to get any sickness. And the reason why I find myself in this headspace is because we have been lied to by public health officials and manipulated by public health officials for so long. And again, I certainly concede, I don't think every single one who was doing the manipulating were doing so with nefarious intent. I don't believe that. I don't. And maybe I'm naive for not thinking that, but I think most people are probably in my camp who are a little bit suspicious, let's just say, of statements coming from public health officials. But they did this to themselves. Truly, they did this to themselves. When they knowingly lied to us about the vaccine, knowingly lied. And I fell for it. Lots of people fell for it. They told me that I can't trust them. When they told us, despite all of the data, that it's dangerous to go outside, even though COVID can barely ever be passed along outside, it takes a lot for you to catch COVID outside. When they lied to us, despite what the data said, and again, that was a lie. They might have done it for the right reasons, or they thought were the right reasons, but it was still a lie. They told me not to trust them. When they shut down the schools, and some are still talking about shutting down schools. Go listen to Fauci's interview. I think it was on Meet the Press. It was over the weekend. It was on one of the Sunday shows. Kind of opening, it was CNN, kind of opening the door to the possibility of shutting down schools again without just categorically saying, no, why would we do that to our kids? We know that it's dangerous. When they decided to do that and take that position, they told us all that we shouldn't necessarily trust them. They did this to themselves. And they're going to have to live with the consequences. And by the way, so are we, because there will be times in which public health officials will take positions that are incredibly necessary and important for us to listen to. And a lot of people won't. A lot of people will presume that they are being treated the same way they were treated during COVID. And that is dangerous for all of us. I don't get the sense that public health officials are interested in apologizing for what they did and what they said and what they claimed. Even when they made honest mistakes, don't get a lot of apologies or explanations, none of it, which means they're not doing any of the damage control, damage that they caused. And that has serious consequences. Now this.
The interview.
Brian Haywood wants to actually fix what's broken in Washington State, which is why he's putting not only a lot of energy, but his own money into a series of petitions that you need to sign. Let's go. Washington.com has the list. Brian Haywood joins me now. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Jason. Thanks for having us on again. It's been a sort of a wild ride with this election.
I bet. Let's give just very quickly a sort of big picture overview of the initiatives, because you're hitting a lot of the issues that people care about most.
That's right. There's the big one. I think the one that's in some ways the most popular is the crime, the one to sort of fix what's broken with the way that our police are allowed to chase criminals. And so that's the big one, right? The
1474
chase again. That's right. Right behind it, I would say that one of the next most popular ones, and actually on the crime one, make hard drugs illegal, right? We softened up our rules and we made them legal, essentially, and the Supreme Court sort of threw out their ability to prosecute. Another one that's very popular is cutting the gas tax by 24.7 cents a gallon. And as you know, the gas is going to go up about 50 cents a gallon anyway in January. So we're trying to get ahead of that. We want to exempt the first $250,000 of value on your home from a property tax, from state property tax. And we'd like to repeal the capital gains tax. It's illegal. A judge ruled it illegal, and the Supreme Court is going to rule on it in January. We'd like to preempt them and say, no, the people have spoken a bunch of times on this, and we don't want an income tax.
How concerned are you that the state Supreme Court allowing the state to collect capital gains tax indicates how they're going to view this once they actually rule?
Very worried. I would like them to be honest and go about it in an honest way and look at what the precedent is and what the rules are. But to me, they're sending the signal. They're saying, even though a lower court has ruled that this is an illegal tax and therefore it's not on the books, the Department of Revenue can go ahead and start preparing to collect the tax. That to me is extremely worrisome. It signals they're not looking at this in an unbiased way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's clear that the Democrats chose to pass a capital gains tax knowing it's unconstitutional because it would get in front of this state Supreme Court. And they have shown no interest in taking politics out of their rulings, any one of the rulings, including rulings in which maybe they side with the law, they still try to actually put politics into it. And it's terrifying.
That's absolutely right. It's bad enough that we've got one party rule here for 40 years. I think when you get your judiciary actively putting its finger down on the balance of scales, then you've got a, like what you said, it's not just, oh, that's bad. It's sort of terrifying when you've got a court that's not ruling based on law, but ruling based on ideology.
So folks can order the petitions at letsgowashington.com. This is a good way if you want to not just sign it for you and your family, but do some activism of your own. Get activated. Go door to door. Go to some of your friends and family members who you know are interested in getting the state on the right track, and they can sign them that way. But you're also at various locations throughout Western Washington, and actually throughout the state. But for the people who are listening right now in Western Washington, you know, folks who live in Gig Harbor can go to ABC Bookkeeping in front of the JCPenney every single day. You've got folks collecting at the Black Diamond Gun Club for anyone who lives in Black Diamond. Or if you're listening and you're, I don't know, in Bonnie Lake, go to CJ's Deli. There's a location there that you can just go ahead and sign. But you guys are doing these all over the place.
We are. And one of the things that we're really pushing right now is we're trying to get in front of the Walmarts. One of the big challenges has been that COVID Karens made a lot of Walmart managers afraid to have anyone out there. But we found some that are sort of bold enough, and we're setting up a camp in front of Walmarts. We'll be collecting there. And one of the things I'd like to emphasize, one of the early things you said, this is really a chance for people to do something instead of sitting back and going, crap. The legislature does things we don't like, and I can't do anything about it. If people would get not only sign themselves, but go out and fill out one or two and get their friends to fill them out. That's the way we're going to be able to do this. If you remember, when we tried to do the capital gains tax, it ended up the consultants were going to charge us $8 million to do one initiative. And the only way we break that is if we as a people get active, get busy, talk to our friends, go collect 20 signatures and get them to collect 20 signatures. We'll make it that way.
And of course, there are businesses that have stepped up like Sub-Zero Ice Cream and Federal Way. You can go over there and sign any one of these initiatives. Wade's Eastside Guns in Bellevue, they've got it daily. You're able to go there, just ask for it, and you'll be able to sign it. And again, you can check out letsgowashington.com for not just the locations, but as Brian pointed out, and as I pointed out, you can simply just ask for them to mail them to you, and you can do some of your own activism out in the community. It's time to step up. Last question for you, Brian. What did you make more generally of the Washington election results? Does this give you pause as to whether or not we're going in the right direction?
First of all, I think it was really disappointing on the one hand. On the other hand, though, I think it made, you know, if we had had a giant red wave, I think there would be a certain former president that would be running around the country claiming credit for all of it. Mm-hmm. And without getting too deep into the weeds, I think it's not a bad, I think he did a great job, but I think it's time for us to have the next candidate, and this might clear the way for that to happen, and that might be a good thing for Washington State.
Yeah. In the meantime, let's make sure we're getting those signatures. If you live in Hobart, go to the Hobart Market. They've got their, that's a location where you can sign these petitions. If you are, let's see, Kitsap Mall, you can hang out over there by the food court next to the play area. There's a location on coming up that you can go ahead and sign these petitions. Make sure, again, head on over to letsgowashington.com. We got to get these initiatives signed. We got to get them on the ballot, and we've got to allow Washingtonians to actually have a say in all these issues that are impacting us deeply, and yet we don't really have a say because Democrats have total control of the legislature. Letsgowashington.com. Brian Haywood, thank you so much for stopping by. Really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Jason. There's one more thing. If people actually, we're willing to hire volunteers who are looking for some Christmas money. We've got a program where we've got some locations we're actually staffing. If they want to go to Let's Go On, reach out to us. We've got a program for somebody that wants to go out and help gather signatures for us on a more full-time basis.
Perfect. Make sure, guys, you're getting involved. This is a really good way to make some money heading into the holiday season. Brian Haywood, thank you.
Thank you, sir. We'll talk to you soon.
You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. Now this.
The interview.
Well, I think there are some good things to read out of the jobs report. Some not so good things. Helping us understand it all from Fox Business is our friend Edward Lawrence. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Jason, thanks.
So there's some good, there's some bad. Take us through the good first.
So the good, obviously, overall, 263,000 jobs added back to the economy is a boom. It was supposed to be, the expectation was 200,000. It beat that again. This shows that, you know, companies are still hiring. Now, we're hearing about layoffs in the tech sector, but clearly this jobs report shows that those layoffs are not spreading to other industries. And for right now, that is a good thing.
Why do you suppose it's not spreading? Why, or really, why is the tech industry getting hit so hard?
Well, the tech industry is getting hit so hard because advertising. Advertisers are a little jittery about how much money with inflation that they're seeing. Their products are costing more. They're going to have to, they're cutting back in certain areas in order to try and make those margins that they need. And one of the areas they're cutting back in is advertising in some. So the tech industry is being hit by advertising sales that are falling. And that's the reason they're having the layoffs.
Now, the not so good news has to do with the participation rate, which is still not where it needs to be.
Exactly. And the not so good news has to do with the 263,000 jobs that were added to the economy, because that tells the Federal Reserve that it's not doing enough to slow down the economy. And it gives the Federal Reserve a green light for more aggressive rate hikes. Now, we'll likely get 50 basis points or half a percentage point in December. But if these reports keep coming in like this, it tells the Federal Reserve they can keep raising rates into next year, which is what I heard from when I interviewed New York Federal Reserve President John Williams. He said that they see continued rate hikes, and the interest rate when they're all said and done will be higher than people think it should be.
It is just very weird, because when you've got the inflation rate where it is, where you've got, to your point, the necessity of raising the interest rates, and yet someone says, but the economy is so strong that doesn't make sense. It really does make sense. That's why the Fed is kind of in a weird position.
In a very weird position, especially for the markets, where good news is bad news. You know, you have good news, a good jobs report, unemployment rate stayed at 3.7%. You know, the bad news on that is it stayed at 3.7% because of the amount of people who left the workforce. It was something like 186,000. Yep. I have to look up that number.
No, it was 186. Yeah.
Yeah, 186,000 people left the workforce. They just either retired or just gave up looking for a job. You know, some of that might have to do with government benefits. If you go back to the report earlier this week, it said that personal income went up in part because of increased social benefits, and that's in the Bureau of Economic Analysis earlier this week released a report that had that talking about personal income. And the reason personal income went up in part because of increased government social benefits.
There's also an issue at play that I don't think is getting nearly enough attention, which is remote working and the impact it's having on the economy. You can get people who are working, kudos, awesome, you're working hard, or at least pretending to work hard in your pajamas from home. But that also means you're not going into the office where you otherwise would be going to a nearby restaurant or a nearby Starbucks or whatever it is. And those businesses are suffering.
Exactly. It's a ripple effect. It's like throwing a stone into a pond. You know, that stone would be the person spending money going into the office, going to buy lunch, going to get lunch for coworkers, or buying office supplies that they need in the nearby store. And that ripple effect, that just isn't happening at the moment. You know, one other thing in this jobs report that came out, 600,000 more people are now taking multiple jobs to be able to afford it. That as from a year ago. So that is up 600,000 people having to take, you know, you could have somebody who's working at a restaurant, who is, you know, waiting tables or working even at a front desk at a hotel, and then they have to go drive Uber just to pay the rent, which has increased, you know, 11% year over year.
Same time, you've got the housing market seeming to be heading for a crash. I mean, it's cooling dramatically here in Seattle. I know Austin had a report out recently saying that it's getting pretty dire there as well. Where do we see the housing bubble?
Yeah, and the Federal Reserve is saying it's not a bubble. They are watching this, but that's what they're trying to do. So with these interest rate hikes, the mortgage rate goes up. And the mortgage rate above 7%, people stop buying, slows down that. And then you have, again, that ripple effect, because if you don't buy a home, you're not going to buy a washer or dryer. You're not going to buy a refrigerator. So there's other things that go with the home you're just not going to buy. And that's how they slow down the economy. You know, the Federal Reserve is saying it's not a bubble and they are watching housing closely. But clearly you have sellers that are holding on to the value saying, no, I believe my home is worth more. And you have buyers saying, well, I'm just going to sit on the sideline because it costs me more to get the loan, the mortgage, as mortgage rates rise. So I'm just not going to buy right now. So there is a give and take there. And at some point, the seller is going to have to give in this environment and lower the price. And you're going to start to see that. But we are starting to see home sales severely slow down.
Yeah, here in Seattle, we're the number two slowest pace year over year of growth in the housing market. Number one is San Francisco, followed by us, the Minneapolis, Portland, and D.C. I suppose if you're a cash buyer, you might be excited for what's to come, I suppose, in the next year. But other than that, it just doesn't seem like we're headed in the right direction. And it's the mixed messages allows, frankly, both Republicans and Democrats to stick to talking points, right? I mean, President Biden is out there saying, oh, the economy is strong. Look at all the data. But it's not as strong in the sense that normal people would view it.
Right. He's out saying, look at how many jobs I'm creating. Look at how I'm doing with this economy. But he's not mentioning the fact that, yes, you know, workers' wages are up and they're up 5.1% year over year. But you know what? Inflation is 7.7% year over year. I mean, just go to the grocery store, just go to Starbucks. You know, all companies have basically raised their prices this year, little by little by little, but it all adds up. And so workers are finding that their paychecks are not going as far as they went a year ago, even 6 months ago. And that is the other side of this issue. So the president would like you to see the top line number, the amount of jobs that are coming back into the workforce. And they are. There are a lot of jobs. All of the jobs were added that were lost in the pandemic, and the economy has created 1 million jobs above that from this jobs report. But again, you know, there could be more than that, you know, if some of the policies might have been different. You just don't know. I mean, you could Monday morning quarterback this, but at this point, you know, the president has the energy policies, you know, sort of slowed down the economy. Some would argue, the economists that I've talked with, some of them have argued that the increased social benefits from the American Rescue Plan that basically paid people not to work until September of last year, that kept folks out of the labor force, that didn't jumpstart the job labor force. And now we're starting to see some of that struggle where people just, hey, I don't want to work. You know, I don't want to go to a job where I have to go to an office. I'm happy doing what I'm doing. I'm getting rental assistance, so I don't need to cover my rent. So there's some weak spots that can be seen through the president's policies.
Well, hopefully with the new makeup of the House, things will get a little bit different, a little bit better. We've been talking with Edward Lawrence, who's the White House correspondent for Fox Business. Every once in a while, I get to be his warm-up act on Varney & Company. Edward, thank you so much for stopping by. I appreciate it.
I think I'm the warm-up act. You're the headliner.
Oh, there we go. I do like the butt kissing. That's always my favorite. I'm supposed to be the one doing it to you because you're the guest. Edward Lawrence.
Get me an invite back, right?
You're definitely invited back. That, of course, is Edward Lawrence from Fox Business. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show.
The Jason Rand Show.
Always glad to see Seattle radio host Jason Rance.
It's always a pleasure to watch you and a pleasure now to host you.
Jason, I just love your coverage of what's been going on in Seattle.
Jason, this is as bad as it gets in America.
Jason Rance, great to see you. Thank you.
Long Form, presented by Northgate Rare Coins and Precious Metals.
Well, it was certainly cold today. It was a little gross and gray, and then the sun came out, and then it got gray again. But didn't really get a lot of snow, just some flurries. Well, we get snow this weekend. We turn to the guy with the crystal ball. And by crystal ball, I mean he's got access to a lot of data. Cliff Mass is UW Atmospheric Sciences professor, and he joins me now. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot.
So what does all the data suggest? Are we going to get snow this weekend?
Well, it depends where you are. Here in Seattle, not much. This is not going to be a replay of a few days ago where North Seattle and Snohomish County got buried. So what's going to happen is tonight a weak front is coming in. There'll be snow on the Olympics, and Kitsap County will get it. And I expect some snow several inches up in Whatcom County. But here in Seattle, there'll be very little. Maybe in the northwest side of the city and in southern Snohomish County, we may get a half an inch to an inch at the very most. And it could be zero. So, you know, not a big event here in central Puget Sound. But you go to Kitsap and you go up to Whatcom County, and they could get something.
What about on the east side of the state?
Not too much. The trouble is the front is coming in from the coast. It's kind of stalling along the coast, so very little in eastern Washington. There'll be another weak event on Sunday morning into Sunday afternoon, and then it'll be southwest Washington and a little bit in eastern Washington, but not a lot.
Now, at the same time, it is going to be cold, though. It's going to be freezing, it looks like.
Well, although it'll warm up a bit. Now, tomorrow will seem like a heat wave, perhaps. Temperatures get into the upper 30s, maybe even 40 here in the lowlands.
Quite the heat wave.
So, you know, it's not even up to normal temperatures, but it will warm up a bit. It'll definitely get above freezing, which means all the roads will be in good condition.
And I know you don't put a lot of stock into long-term predictions or more than just a few days out. Are you seeing anything past the weekend that's got you thinking, it's a possibility?
Well, not for snow in the lowlands. You know, what's going to happen is the ridge of high pressure is going to build over our region from Monday through Wednesday, so it'll be pretty dry, so and some sun, so pretty good. The next system will be coming in on Thursday, and so there will be snow in the mountains quite a bit, but it's going to be too warm for the lowlands. So we'll get some rain in the lowlands. There'll be some snow in eastern Washington and in the Cascades, but that's about it.
Were there any surprises earlier this week other than I think the snow, it's safe to say, started a little bit earlier than you had anticipated?
Well, you know, the models were actually pretty good. I mean, we've come a long way in the last few decades. So actually, if you look at the forecast models, they really were describing what was going to happen, you know, and including the geographical distribution of snow. So there may be some miscommunication by some of the media, but in general, the forecasts were pretty good.
So that's good. When this happens, do you get all excited or do you kind of laugh at some of the media coverage?
Well, you know,
because let's be clear. So some of the media coverage was a little bit crazy, which is why we did something like this.
Stormwatch 2022. It's not snowing, but it could. Maybe.
That's basically what was the truth. And yet the media was just a little nutty.
Well, I mean, the media likes weather because the people really get interested. You know, I have a blog, and when there's snow, the readership goes up by like a factor of 3 to 5. So, I mean, people are really interested in weather, and it's not only for how it affects them, but I think it's also kind of religious. It's like a non-denominational religion that people hold, and when weather gets extreme, people know there's a power greater than them, and they're interested in it.
Well, there's also the factor of blaming it on climate change. Was there anything that we experienced that was, from a historical standpoint, just completely outside of the norm and attributable to climate change?
There was nothing about this that was way outside the norm. And it is true, whenever there's any kind of extreme weather, certain folks like to blame it on climate change. And there's a certain local newspaper in town that does this in spades.
Seattle Times.
Yeah, I think so. So, I mean, the Seattle Times is constantly exaggerating and hyping climate change. I mean, climate change is real, and by that I mean global warming. The planet is slowly warming up, and we're probably contributing to it a little bit, or quite a bit. But, you know, the extreme weather is not all explained by climate change, and every major storm doesn't mean that we're causing it.
Cliff Mass joining me on the line. In addition to talking about the weather, you like to talk about woke madness. In fact, you had the opportunity to be a guest on Mike Solon's podcast. Mike Solon is the Seattle Police Officer Guild president. It's called Hold the Line, and you spoke specifically about the UW, but really just more generally how universities like the University of Washington have a tendency to lean into the wokeness. What is some of you? First, tell us what you explained in a little bit more detail and what the reaction was.
Right. Well, I mean, there's certainly an issue here at the University of Washington. And in fact, there's been some recent ratings of colleges and universities around the United States. And we don't come off too well. For instance, there's a group called FIRE. It's a bipartisan
Foundation
group
for Individual Rights in Education. Wonderful organization.
A wonderful organization and very bipartisan. And they rated the universities and colleges around the United States for, you know, honoring freedom of speech and those kind of issues. And of all the public universities in the country, we were at the bottom of the barrel. I mean, that's very bad. And then there was another rating about, you know, fascism at universities that came out recently. This is an individual named Horowitz and his organization came up with this rating. And we were number two down on the bottom on the fascism side. So there's a number of these national ratings. And I think it's reflecting some things that we're seeing here, you know, from the inside, that there is a suppression or unhappiness with diversified viewpoints here at the university. And a number of us have experienced this. In fact, it's gotten so acute, some undergraduates have gotten together to form an organization, Huskies.
Yep. They were on the show this week.
Oh, they were on the show. They were on your search. So there's the Huskies for Freedom or something like that. Or
Huskies
Liberty.
For Liberty.
Yeah, in fact, I went to their meeting this week, and there's a number of students that have experienced very unpleasant situations in classes when they provided a viewpoint that was different than the instructor was holding.
How has it been for you? You're obviously outspoken. I don't know if you identify actually as a conservative. You certainly lean in that direction, is my guess. But how has it been for you?
Well, politically, I've been quite a moderate liberal type, really, you know, so.
Which makes you a conservative now.
Which perhaps does, I don't know. But, you know, I'm very moderate. I've voted for people on both sides of the aisle here. So, you know, there's no issue there. But I've experienced some real problems here at the university. For instance, I got into big trouble when I did a blog that was against a certain carbon initiative. This is Initiative 1631. I don't know if you're familiar with that. So there were two carbon initiatives in the state. Basically, you know, there would be a tax on
it's a carbon tax.
Carbon, you know, it's a carbon tax. The first one, 732, was very bipartisan, and it was very good. I supported it very strongly. And that got turned down, and it turned out sort of the liberal environmentalists were the ones who were against it because they wanted the money. Then they had another initiative, 1631, in which there was a carbon tax, and they would get the money to give out to their friends, basically. And I was against that. And I got into tremendous trouble here at the university.
Wow. Well, the voters, by the way, were also against it, which is why it failed. And it failed, as I recall, by a pretty significant margin.
That is correct. It failed very, very badly. And so here in my department, there was messages sent around by the chair and some others that my opposition was racist. I was being accused of racism because I didn't support their initiative, right? So there's things like that going on, and I've been on the receiving end
Did they explain how it was racist, by the way? I imagine, and this is because it's all I can write the script for any of this stuff, but any sort of environmental degradation hurts the black community more or disproportionately, environmental racism, blah, 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 blah.
Well, it's partly that, but I think what really got them is I used an analogy they didn't understand. I used an analogy of pigs at the trough. You know, and this is well known for 100 years, this analogy, that's saying that fat cats, you know, were at the public trough, okay?
Yeah.
It was never meant to be talking about minority groups. But they thought that the fact that I was calling, since a lot of minority groups were and, you know, progressive groups were supporting the initiative, that I was calling them pigs by using that analogy, and therefore I'm a racist. It was absurd.
Yeah, and here's a little bit of irony the next time that comes up. Arianna Huffington literally wrote a book called Pigs at the Trough, and it was specifically about corporate greed. I don't remember the subtitle. I can look it up real quickly on Amazon. Okay, Pigs at the Trough, How Corporate Greed and Political Corruption Are Undermining America. And something tells me that book, which came out, it was a while ago, 2004, wasn't deemed a racist. But because back in 2004, people weren't as hypersensitive and crazy as they are in 2022.
But it's more than that. It's the education of these students here at UW. Mm-hmm. Most of them have an extraordinarily poor understanding of history, civics, or anything like that. So this whole thing about pigs at the trough and fat cat, they didn't know anything about it. So their whole, you know, background coming in here is so poor these days that you almost can't have a discussion with them.
Well, it's absolutely nuts. I'm sorry you have to go through all that nonsense. But you know what? Someone has to be sane over at the University of Washington. Between you and Stuart Regis, I'm sure you guys get a heck of a lot of pushback. Cliff Mass is a professor of atmospheric sciences over at the UW. Thank you so much for stopping by. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care.
You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rants. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rants is in focus now.
Jason Rants, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
You know, I've been looking at this study from the College Fix for a couple days now. The Cliff Mass interview we just had reminded me that we didn't get a chance to dive into it. So I thought we would, in the remaining moments of the show, dive into the study because I think it's important. We hear all the time from folks on the left about the importance of diversity. They say that over and over and over again, and they say it with this sort of almost cult-like recitation. Diversity is important. Diversity is important. Diversity is important. Multicultural. They throw all these things, and I believe diversity is important, but I believe actual diversity is important. That's what I actually believe. Like, we have actual diversity. And the problem, unfortunately, is that a lot of universities in this country, universities run by folks on the left, they don't actually value true diversity. So instead, they get a lot of people who look different than each other. And obviously, that is part of what diversity is about, people who have different backgrounds. But if they all think alike, dare I say it's not all that diverse, that maybe the diversity is more superficial than not. So the College Fix found just 61 Republican professors across 65 departments at 7 different universities as part of a survey that they did to look at the party affiliations. Now, obviously, they had to go into certain states because if you are in some states where you don't have to identify your party, it's not going to be easy to figure this out. So they look specifically at the Ohio State University, University of Nebraska at Omaha, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, University of Georgia, Cornell, University of Oklahoma, and University of Alaska at Anchorage. Now, part of the reason why they did that was that 6 of those states are primarily considered to be conservative or Republican run, right? The exception is New York. And yet every single one of those universities, regardless of the political makeup of the community, had a strong Democratic tilt amongst the faculty. They say a total of 33 of the departments that they looked at had 0 Republican professors identified within them. 33 departments had 0 Republican professors. In contrast, 667 professors were identified as Democrat based on political party registration or voting history in party primaries. 667. When broken into Democrat and Republican, 92% of professors identify as Democrat, with only 8% identifying as Republican. They say that amounts to Democrat professors outnumbering Republican professors by a ratio of 11-1. Now, if diversity is important, why would you not consider ideological diversity? Why would you not consider it? Why isn't that part of the conversation about the importance of diversity and learning from people who have different perspectives than you do? When you tell me that, and we hear this, I usually use this when it comes to policing or your doctors, but it works well for professors too. We hear this line: our staff should reflect the community it serves. It should look like the community it serves. Meaning, if you've got a 6% population that's Black, you should have at least 6% professors who are Black. If you have, and really they don't mean that, they want it to be 60%, because if you have a white population that represents 70% of the community, they don't want that. But I mean, you hear that all the time. We want to be a reflection of the community. We want to look like you. Well, why is it just looking like you? What about thinking like the community and sharing some values? Now, it's certainly, and I imagine that some of these people would make this argument, that if you are a state school in particular, you're more likely, obviously, to have people who come from the state and usually who come from the community itself that you're located. So, for example, UW has a lot of Seattle area students. And they'll say, well, if you're in, say, Oklahoma or North Carolina or Kansas, you're going to have more Republicans or conservative-leaning students who go to the school, and so that's the diversity. They're the ones who's actually being served because they've got a lot of liberal professors. But the fact of the matter is, you go to UW, as we just talked about with Cliff Mass, you've got a liberal community and a very liberal, arguably even more liberal, professor staff. So you're not really getting any representation. I believe, truly believe, that we can learn from people who don't see eye to eye on stories or issues or strategies or policies or laws. I think that there's a lot of value in talking to people on the other side. And part of what we do on the show is tell you what the other side is saying and thinking and what they're doing. Now, obviously, politically, we disagree with what they're saying and thinking and doing. But it's important to understand the other side. And I think we all grow as individuals when we are challenged. When we're told by the other side, hey, this is what we think, this is why we think it, it puts us on the defense. And I think being put on the defense and being forced to debate and being forced to acknowledge that we're going to have to do some heavy lifting to convince people to move to our side on certain issues, I think that that makes us grow as individuals. I think we just become smarter, and I think we can adapt better than folks who are constantly coddled. But in a lot of the cases, we're talking about students who aren't, in fact, conservative. Younger people have a tendency to be liberal. Not always, but they have a tendency to be liberal. And so you're throwing them onto these college campuses in which they're basically being told that their views are perfect. And actually, you are morally superior to folks on the other side because of your views. They're not being challenged at all. And then they go into the real world and they completely, and I mean completely, break down when they are challenged even a little bit. I mean, we talked about it in the first hour, what we're seeing with Elon Musk and Twitter. This is the breakdown of liberals who are upset that conservative viewpoints might actually be exposed and they might actually have to read them. And they're simply breaking down. So I would argue that you're not serving these students at all when you're not showing them a staff that thinks just a little bit differently than they do. I'm not a believer in a board of trustees or a staff of professors or a fire department of firefighters looking like the community. I don't believe that it has to look like the community. But I do believe that when you are exposed to things that are a little bit different than you, just a little bit, there's a lot of value. So I buy into a little bit of the diverse workforce aspect only when we're talking about actual diversity. And unfortunately, for the most part, we never seem to be talking about that.
The Last Rants.
And with that, just very quickly, make sure that you're not staying in your little bubble. I've said that before. But this week, after having some conversations with folks who are listeners to the show, God bless them, I get the impression that they're not exposing themselves to other viewpoints. And like I said, there's value to it, but it's not just value when you're some 18-year-old going to school. That value exists as long as you're alive. And that's the Last Rants.